It comes down to embracing four practices. Attach every initiative to a clear purpose or goal. Change for change's sake is stupid and enervating. 2. Hire and promote only true believers and get on with it types. 3. Ferret out and get rid of resistors, even if their performance is satisfactory. 4. Look at car wrecks. If a company's leaders implement these practices with passion and reward everyone else who buys in, eventually all the noise around change will stop sounding like noise. Change will become business as usual, the norm, and when it does, mountains do move. I've seen it happen, and it's not as earth-shattering as it's made out to be. Now for the practices in more detail. 1. Attach every change initiative to a clear purpose or goal. Change, for change's sake, is stupid and enervating. It is a disaster when companies take all the hype about change literally and grab every new management fad that comes down the pike. It's change overload. Some big companies adopt 10 different change initiatives at once and run in 8 different directions. Nothing meaningful ever happens in these flavor-of-the-month kinds of situations, except that for most employees, work feels very frantic and disorganized. Actually, change should be a relatively orderly process. But for that to occur, people have to understand, in their heads and in their hearts, why change is necessary and where the change is taking them. This is easier, of course, when the problems are obvious, as in the house is burning down, earnings are collapsing, a competitor has dropped prices 20%, or a new product appears that totally threatens your market position. Change is made even easier when the media is writing stories about your imminent demise, perhaps the one time you welcome bad press. Many of the most notable large company turnarounds in the past decade had this going for them. GM, IBM, and Xerox, to name 3. When the whole world knows about your problem, the wind is at your back. But sometimes the need for change isn't scrawled across the skies. Competitive threats only seem to be emerging. They may not even be real, or they may be your company's death knell. You don't know. And still, you have to respond. In those cases, lots of data and relentless communication about the business rationale for change are the best ammunition you've got. Take the case of GE's appliances business in the late 1970s. In those days, appliances and lighting were the mainstays of the company. The previous 2 chairmen and several vice chairmen had come from their ranks. As far as everyone in the business was concerned, GE was the leader in major appliances, and it would be that way forever. In 1978, when I was appointed head of the Consumer Products Group, I found myself staring at an appliance business whose market share had been slipping for a few years and whose margins were sliding even faster. To an outsider like me, the situation looked frighteningly similar to the television receiver and automotive businesses, where the Japanese were making tremendous inroads with higher quality, low-cost products, while fat American companies sat by doing little. I made my case to appliances business managers at their headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky. The place was loaded with good old boys, not to mention tons of overhead and layers of bureaucracy. I showed them chart after chart illustrating appliances' eroding position. And yet, early buy-in was minimal, to put it mildly. At the outset, I basically forced the cost reduction program. Almost immediately, I got the 2 refrains common to every cost reduction program ever launched. We've already cut the fat. You're asking us to cut the bone. And the competitors are crazy. They're giving away product. Just watch. They can't keep it up. Fortunately, the head of the business, a good old boy named Dick Donegan, whom I had been prepared to write off, saw the logic of the case, came to my aid, and started to champion Change at Appliances. His leadership was vital to fixing things. He had been with Appliances his entire career, so he knew the players well. He built a team of supporters around him and cleaned out detractors, literally hundreds of them, over a two-year period. In the end, the Appliances business went through drastic changes because it had to. The fact wasn't blindingly obvious in 1978 when the change was launched, nor was it overwhelmingly clear for a few years after. In fact, the Japanese never really sold large appliances in the U.S. Only recently have the Chinese and Koreans made inroads. The domestic competition was tough enough to make change necessary. Just look at the price of a refrigerator today. That's why the appliances business continues to cut costs and still hasn't hit bone. It is now a business characterized by continual productivity improvements, modest innovation, and a team that understands that change is a way of life. One lesson from the appliances story is that you don't always have, at the outset of a change initiative, every bit of information you'd like to make your case. Regardless, you need to get out there and start talking about what you do know and what you fear. Communication about change does get a lot more challenging as a company gets larger. It's one thing if you're the owner of a 200-person machine tool company to walk into work one day, call a meeting and say, "Okay, everyone, I just got back from a sales trip, and guess what? We've got brutal competition from a really innovative new company in Hungary. Things are going to have to change around here." It's another thing entirely to make the case for change to a company with a couple hundred thousand people in multiple business units in multiple countries. In big companies, calls for change are often greeted with a nice head fake. People nod at your presentations and pleasantly agree that given all the data, it sure looks like change is necessary. Then they go back to doing everything they always did. If the company has been through enough change programs, employees consider you like gas pains. You'll go away if they just wait long enough. This pervasive skepticism is all the more reason that anyone leading a change process must stay far away from empty slogans and instead stick to a solid, persuasive business case. Over time, logic will win out. The second practice to consider when you're going through a change process evolves around hiring and promoting only true believers and get on with it types. Everyone in business claims they like change. To say otherwise nowadays would be career suicide. In fact, it's quite common to see someone describe himself as a change agent right on his resume. That's ridiculous. By my estimate, real change agents comprise less than 10% of all business people. These are the true believers who champion change, know how to make it happen, and love every second of the process. A significant majority, about 70 to 80% more, may not lead the charge, but once they are convinced change is necessary, they say, "Okay, get on with it." The rest are resistors. To make change happen, companies must actively hire and promote only true believers and get on with it. But with everyone claiming to like change, how can you tell who's for real? Luckily, change agents usually make themselves known. They're typically brash, high energy, and more than a little bit paranoid about the future. Very often they invent change initiatives on their own or ask to lead them. Invariably they are curious and forward-looking. They ask a lot of questions that start with the phrase, "Why don't we?" These people have courage, a certain fearlessness about the unknown. Something in them makes it okay to operate without a safety net. If they fail, they know they can pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and move on. They're thick-skinned about risk, which allows them to make bold decisions without a lot of data. This description makes me think immediately about Dennis Naden, a managing partner with Oak Hill Capital Management, whom I've known for more than 20 years. Dennis joined GE Capital in 1977, right out of the University of Connecticut, and by 1989 was second in charge, helping Gary Wendt expand the business from a few hundred million dollars in net income to more than $5 billion in 2000. The best word to describe Dennis is intense, but extremely smart and fanatical about growth also work well. He never saw a deal he couldn't make better. He never saw a routine or process that couldn't be unpicked, shaken up, and improved. In fact, Dennis always saw the status quo as something to be upended. And in doing so, he brought hundreds of GE Capital's deals to unparalleled heights of performance. He always gave people a view beyond what they were to what they could be. Now, Dennis, like most change agents, is not always easy to work for. He constantly asks questions, pushes people hard, and just never settles. In the process, some people can feel threatened or scared. But Dennis is not a whatever works, smooth things over kind of person. Successful change agents rarely are. The point here is that to make change, you need true believers at the top and get on with it types everywhere else. Take the case of Bob Nardelli at the Home Depot. The Home Depot, like GE's appliances business, was a company where the idea of change seemed ludicrous to most people in the organization. When Bob arrived in December 2000, the company looked perfect from the outside, and everyone inside was thrilled with the level of earnings and growth. The founders of the company had done a remarkable job of building the company from nothing. Along the way, sharing stock options with thousands of employees who loved the ride as the profits soared through the 90s. But two things were happening that no one wanted to face. The business had gotten big with few internal processes in place, careful inventory tracking, stocking policies, and buying guidelines, to name three, and was having trouble maintaining its competitiveness. Lowe's, its principal competitor, was chipping away at the Home Depot's lead with better service and more modern stores. Bob was running the company for about a month when he started boldly talking about these problems, using tons of data. But few people at any level were buying his story of Home Depot as a fixer-upper. Many employees from the good old days openly pined for the times when the founders ran the company and everyone was getting richer by the hour. Who could blame them for that nostalgia? But things had to change, and Bob knew that he couldn't do that with the team he had inherited. He quickly brought in his own people, true believers, and promoted several longtime employees whom he had identified as get-on-with-its. Together, they put the missing processes into Home Depot and got growth back into the company. In this case, Bob had no wind at his back, but he did have the right people by his side. The third best practice, and perhaps the toughest one to implement, is to ferret out and remove the resistors, even if their performance is satisfactory. In the last chapter, I talked about how hard it is to let anyone go, but it is particularly difficult to fire people who are not actually screwing up and may, in fact, be doing quite well. But in any organization, as the appliances and Home Depot stories show, there is a core of people who absolutely will not accept change, no matter how good your case. Either their personalities just can't take it, or they're so entrenched emotionally, intellectually, or politically in the way things are, they cannot see a way to make them better. These people usually have to go. Maybe that sounds harsh, but you are doing no one a favor by keeping resistors in your organization. They foster an underground resistance, and lower the morale of the people who support change. They waste their own time at a company where they don't share the vision, and they should be encouraged to find one where they do. Take this extraordinary example. It's about Bill Harrison, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, who asked a well-respected, high-level executive to leave during his change process at the bank. His move was even more stunning in that Bill did it when his own political capital was low, in the middle of the Enron collapse, when many people wondered if Bill would personally take the fall for the bank's loans to Enron and to other high-profile troubled companies. During this period, Bill was instituting an executive training initiative focused on transforming the newly merged J.P. Morgan and Chase into a more market-focused bank, a big change for an institution whose businesses, like many of those on Wall Street, prided themselves on their individuality. The biggest resistor was the CEO of one of J.P. Morgan Chase's major businesses, a true star in his own right. He preferred the lone wolf culture of an investment bank and launched a quiet revolt over Bill's direction. So Bill asked him to leave. It took tremendous courage given the circumstances, but Bill knew, and he was right, that the transformation of J.P. Morgan Chase could not move forward with such a resistor and his following in the way. Candor and fairness made the departure go well. And Bill's program went on to succeed, too. In a survey of all bank executives taken 2 years after his leadership program started, those who participated in the initiative had a favorable impression of the bank's direction, 20 points higher than those who had not participated. From a management perspective, few cases of removing resistors are as difficult as the one Bill Harrison faced. But even when a situation is not nearly as political or fraught, I have seen managers hold on to resistors because of a specific skill set or because they've been around for a long time. Don't! Resistors only get more diehard and their followings more entrenched as time goes on. They are change killers. Cut them off early. The fourth practice looks at what I call car wrecks. Most companies capitalize on obvious opportunities. When a competitor fails, they move in on their customers. When a new technology emerges, they invest in it and create product line extensions. But to be a real change organization, you also have to have the guts to look at bolder, scarier, more unpredictable events and assess and make the most of the opportunities they present. This capability takes a certain determination and sometimes a strong stomach, but the rewards can be huge. Take the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Currency traders certainly capitalized on this awful event. They live on exploiting change. But they're not the only ones who should do this. GE had real success buying undervalued Thai auto loans in this period. Others prospered by buying real estate at fire sale prices. The Japanese banking woes of the 90s gave numerous companies a chance to pick up assets at attractive prices and participate in a market that had previously been closed to them. Companies like the buyout firm Ripplewood Holdings, AIG, Citigroup, and GE, to name a few, made huge gambles in a horrible-looking environment that had just about every pundit predicting the permanent demise of Japan. Those bets are turning out to be big winners as Japan recovers. Bankruptcies are another calamity that provide all kinds of opportunities. They're tragic to the employees. Jobs are lost, and pensions disappear into thin air. But jobs and futures can also be created from the cinders. When Enron fell apart, a tragic business story if there ever was one, Warren Buffett was able to take a position in his former pipeline business at a bargain basement price. and GE picked up its wind power business at what it considered a very good price. The Vivendi collapse was a disaster for CEO Jean-Marie Messier, many employees, and company shareowners. But its financial needs provided the opportunity for Edgar Bronfman to re-enter the music business at an attractive price, and for GE to purchase terrific media assets. It goes without saying that no business person wants disasters to occur, but they will. There'll be spikes in oil prices. Buildings will be destroyed in earthquakes. Companies will go bankrupt, and countries will come close. In today's world, there is the persistent threat of a terrorist attack. Yet even if terrorism is eventually contained, unfortunately something that is not imminent, there will always be elections and revolutions that change the course of history. Most companies take advantage of obvious opportunities, but some also have the ability to make the most of regrettable circumstances, those car wrecks, and they should. Since 9/11, for instance, an entirely new kind of security industry has emerged. Of course, you wish with everything in you that such an industry didn't have to exist, but these companies will benefit for having realized that change means seizing every opportunity, even the ones wrought by adversity. With all the noise out there about change, it's easy to get overwhelmed and confused. But there are really just four practices that matter. Communicate a sound rationale for every change. Have the right people at your side. Get rid of the resistors and seize every single opportunity, even those from someone else's misfortune. That's it. Don't get all caught up in your knickers over change. You just don't need to. The final chapter in the Your Company section is about crisis management. I call it going from, oh God, no, to yes, we're fine. It's no wonder that crisis management is often referred to as firefighting. Like a four-alarm blaze, an event of the oh God, no variety can really consume an organization. Managers huddle in meeting after meeting, trying to figure out what the heck is going on, while everyone else gathers in little clumps all over the office to whisper. They wring their hands over whose head is going to roll. They obsess about their jobs, pointing fingers up, down, and sideways. Often panic rages so high that real work grinds to a halt. Sound familiar? Look, crises happen. As long as companies are made up of human beings, there will be mistakes, controversies, and blow-ups. There will be accidents, theft, and fraud. The cold truth is that some degree of unwanted and unacceptable behavior is inevitable. If people always followed the rules, there'd be no police forces, courthouses, or jails. For leaders, crises often stand out as the most painful and trying experiences of their business lives. Crises can create anxiety-ridden days, sleepless nights, and a churning in the pit of your stomach like no other challenge you face. And on top of it all, crises demand from leaders a daunting balancing act. On one hand, you've got to throw everything you've got into understanding and solving the crisis. You have to unleash a torrent of time and energy, mainly your own, at dousing the flames. At the same time, you have to put that activity into a compartment and carry on as if nothing is actually wrong. That's what leaders usually neglect, to their regret, because when you only focus on the crisis, it can overtake the whole organization, sucking it into a vortex of blame, dread, and paralysis. This balancing act is obviously brutal to pull off in the midst of an event that feels like a living hell. At the outset, you never have all the information you want or need, and solutions often emerge much more slowly than you'd like. And the ending to a crisis rarely seems completely fair or right. good people sometimes get hurt, and all you can really be happy about is that the mess is finally over. And each crisis is different. Some are entirely internal affairs with swift solutions. Others are huge media events with all sorts of legal ramifications. The uniqueness of each crisis makes it hard to come up with rules for getting through them. There are, however, five things you can assume about how your crisis will unfold. These assumptions played out in virtually every crisis I managed, from aircraft engines bribery case involving an Israeli Air Force general, to the company's battle with the government over time card accuracy, to the Kidder Peabody scandal, where an employee misrepresented earnings by millions of dollars. These assumptions aren't a formula for managing a crisis, but hopefully they'll provide directional guidance as you get from, oh God, no, back to, yes, we're fine again. First, assume the problem is worse than it appears. Managers can waste a lot of time at the outset of a crisis denying that something went wrong. Don't let that happen to you. Skip the denial step and get into the mindset that the problem will get bigger, messier, and more awful than you can possibly imagine. Second, assume there are no secrets in the world and that everyone will eventually find out everything. One of the most common tendencies inside the crisis vortex is containment, in which managers frantically try to clamp down on information flow. It's far better to get out ahead of the problem, exposing its scope before someone else does it for you. Third, assume you and your organization's handling of the crisis will be portrayed in the worst possible light. It's not the job of the media to make you or your organization look good during a crisis, and they won't. And never mind the media. Your own organization can be a tough audience during times of trouble. In both cases, the implication is the same. Define your own position early and often. Fourth, assume there'll be changes in processes and people. Almost no crisis ends without blood on the floor. Real crises don't just fade away. They require solutions that overhaul current processes or introduce new ones, and just as often, upend lives and careers. Fifth, assume your organization will survive, ultimately stronger for what happened. We learn something from every single crisis that made us a smarter and more effective organization. Taking that long view might make living in the hellish moment somewhat more bearable. Last year in Amsterdam, we met a Dutch journalist who had recently recovered from an illness that had robbed her of her memory for 2 years. She recounted to us the worst aspect of amnesia for her, which she described as her lack of immunity in life. Every time she made a mistake, like touching a hot stove or not bringing an umbrella out in a rainstorm, it was as if it was for the first time. She never learned anything from experience. At the time we met, the journalist was covering the crisis unfolding at the Dutch food retailer Ahold, which had been accused of a serious accounting fraud. In our conversation, she wondered what would become of the company if its troubles passed. Having touched the stove, would it do so again? Or would its financial accounting be more tightly controlled than ever before? I volunteered that Ahold might make other mistakes in the future, but it was highly unlikely to make a similar accounting error for a long, long time. Companies typically go to extremes after a crisis. They throw up fortresses of rules and procedures to fight the enemy that got in once. Or to use the Dutch journalist metaphor, they build a kind of immunity to the sickness that fell them, the way a child cannot get chickenpox twice. So there is a sliver of silver lining to crisis management. in that you rarely have to live through the same disaster twice. That said, you can be proactive in preventing some crises. There are three main ways, and most companies have the first two pretty much nailed. The first is tight controls, disciplined financial and accounting systems with tough internal and external auditing processes. An organization's line managers should be required to review and act on every audit's findings. The second way to prevent crises is with good internal processes, such as rigorous hiring procedures, candid performance reviews, and comprehensive training programs that make the company's policies nothing short of crystal clear. When it comes to acceptable behaviors, rules, and regulations, you simply cannot train too much. The third way is less common and certainly less of a layup. A culture of integrity, meaning a culture of honesty, transparency, fairness, and strict adherence to rules and regulations. In such cultures, there can be no head fakes or winks. People who break the rules do not leave the company for what is called personal reasons or to spend more time with their families. They are hanged publicly, and the reasons are made painfully clear to everyone. Perhaps the lawyers will warn you against saying too much, but if you've got the facts right, you should be comfortable laying out who broke the rules and how. There are enormous organizational benefits from making examples of people who have violated your policies. Maybe public vilifications and punishments sound harsh, but they are the best way to increase the chances that when somebody in your organization lights a match, that is, commits an integrity transgression, at least a couple of onlookers will immediately shout, "Fire!" Prevention is by no means a perfect science, but it's your first line of defense against a crisis. Don't rely on hard experience to build your immunity, unless you absolutely have to. Before we talk about each assumption, let's take a short look at how crises tend to unfold and roll to their conclusions. Most of the time, crises blindside you. They begin with someone stopping you in the cafeteria and asking a perplexing, "Did you hear?" kind of question, or with an email or letter about a possible irregularity, or with a phone call you would never expect in a million years. The last of those is what happened in 1985, when the General Counsel of GE phoned to say there was an investigation of time card irregularities going on in our Valley Forge, Pennsylvania factory that made missile cones for the government. I had never worked in a business where employees apportioned their time by project, let alone filled out a job time card myself. All I knew was that the people in our aerospace business had nothing to gain from jiggering this process, since the engineers involved were all paid on salary only. My initial reaction was a totally unruffled, keep me posted. He did, and before I knew it, the time card situation had erupted into a firestorm that took a lot of people's time and focus during my early years as CEO. Now, some crises explode with a single event, like the Exxon Valdez breaking up off the coast of Alaska, dumping millions of gallons of crude oil, or when Johnson & Johnson suddenly discovered that someone was tampering with bottles of Tylenol. But most crises don't detonate like bombs. They emerge in fits and starts. I don't know the details of the Merck situation with Vioxx, but I would bet that it actually started a few years ago with a couple of seemingly random incidents of heart problems in people taking the drug. Those reports might have led to a vague suspicion by some scientists that Vioxx was involved, and eventually a larger study was undertaken. From there, the situation probably grew into the full-blown recall that took place in the fall of 2004. Most often, that's how crises go. They seep out and roll toward their solutions, like snowballs down a mountain. They bounce and zigzag and pick up weight and speed. You can never be entirely sure where their paths will end. You can be sure, however, that they will end. The trip to the bottom of the mountain will probably be unpleasant, but eventually it's over and normal life resumes. That is, until another crisis emerges. And now for the five assumptions to keep in mind when a crisis happens. Assumption one, the problem is worse than it appears. No matter how hard you might wish and pray, very few crises start small and stay that way. The vast majority are bigger in scope than you can ever imagine with that first phone call, and they will last longer and get more ugly. More people than you thought will be involved, more lawyers than you've ever seen will poke their noses in, and more terrible things will be said and published than your worst nightmare. So adjust your mindset early on. Go into every crisis assuming the absolute worst has occurred somewhere in your organization, and just as important, that you completely own the problem. In other words, go so far as to assume your company did it and you have to fix it. My tepid response to the time card crisis is case in point here about the importance of having the right mindset, which I did not. With my lack of experience in crisis management, I assumed the problem just couldn't be that bad, given that no one stood to gain personally from misallocating their hours. Maybe a few people had been sloppy with their time cards and winged it, I thought. But so what? The so what was all in the timing. Caspar Weinberger had just been named Secretary of Defense, and he was spearheading President Reagan's famous campaign against government fraud, waste, and abuse. The newspapers were filled with stories about companies charging the government $400 for hammers and $1,000 for toilet seats. We were up next. The facts, as we came to learn, were that 99.5% of the thousands of time cards filed in the Pennsylvania plant had been filled out correctly. It didn't matter. 0.5% of them were not, and that was a violation. Instead of facing that, we got all caught up in our own logic. It went like this. Most of the time cards were correct, and the errors were accidental. Overall, we had actually undercharged the government. This is all just a political witch hunt. With a seasoned mindset, I would have said, we were wrong. Let's do what it takes to correct the situation and put it behind us. I'm not saying that the correct mindset means you should always fold at the get-go. Sometimes you're absolutely clean and you need to fight. In 1992, a former employee turned whistleblower from our diamond business claimed that we had colluded with De Beers to set prices in the industrial diamond market. Knowing the people charged with collusion, I felt certain that this was just a case of a disgruntled guy who should have been let go with more sensitivity. Nevertheless, we dug into the investigation as if we were guilty, looking for every shred of evidence that could be used against us. We turned up nothing. That allowed us to take on the government with everything we had, and we won big when a federal judge threw out the government's case in 1994. The same "we own it" mindset got us successfully through another crisis. In the late 80s, the people running our appliances business in Louisville, Kentucky, began to hear rumblings from the field that an unusual number of refrigerator compressors were requiring repair a year or two out of the factory. The highest volume of breakdowns was coming from the warm weather states. After a few months, the problem spread north, and I was brought into the loop. We immediately assembled a SWAT team of experts from every part of the company, metallurgists and statisticians from corporate research and development, design engineers from aircraft engines, who had experience with rotating parts, and marketing people who had studied the consumer impact of other national product recalls. The team met weekly for a month and spoke on the phone every day to review new data and sort through options. Within 3 months, it was clear that the only course of action was a national recall. We had to take a $500 million write-off, and we received some unpleasant coverage about our technical capabilities in the Wall Street Journal. But grasping the scope of the problem early and taking ownership of its solution ultimately resulted in a lot of goodwill from consumers. The point is, at the first glimmer of a crisis, don't flinch. Get into a worst-case scenario mindset and start digging. Assume you have a major problem on your hands that's yours to fix. Assumption 2. There are no secrets in the world, and everyone will eventually find out everything. In the chapter on people management, discussing the corrosive effect of layers, I mentioned the children's game of telephone. In it, the first person in a circle whispers a secret to the second, who passes to a third, and round it goes until the last person announces what message has reached him. Not surprisingly, the final version has no resemblance to the original. Telephone gets played during crises, too. Information you try to shut down will eventually get out, and as it travels, it will certainly morph, twist, and darken. The only way to prevent that is to expose the problem yourself. If you don't, you can be sure someone will do it for you, and you will look the worse for it. Now I know what you're thinking. You're saying legal won't let us. And you're right. During a crisis, your lawyers will tell you to say less, not more. They will warn you not to implicate Joe or Joyce because their involvement is not yet clear. That advice is not all wrong, but don't take it as gospel. Push lawyers to let you say as much as you can. Just make sure that what you do say is the total truth, with no shades of gray. Cases of full disclosure in businesses abound, but Johnson & Johnson probably set the gold standard with its handling of the town hall crisis in the 1980s. It held press conferences every day, and sometimes more than once, to describe the situation and its scope. It opened its packaging factories up for scrutiny and kept the public posted on a frequent basis on its investigation of the problem and its recall efforts. But perhaps some of the best examples of full disclosure come from the newspaper industry. In 1980, the Washington Post ran a detailed series describing how one of its reporters, Janet Cook, managed to fool her editors, the public, and the Pulitzer Prize jury into believing a horrific tale of an 8-year-old heroin addict. Or take the New York Times and its coverage of Jason Blair, its reporter who fabricated numerous articles. The paper put its best investigative reporters on the case, and their articles left no part of the story untouched. The paper's own practices and leaders were challenged so thoroughly and personally that at times the coverage felt like an unedited family movie. And yet in the end, it was the Times' transparency during the crisis that saved its credibility. The more it said about Jason Blair's falsifications, the more people trusted it, not less. The more it revealed the internal dynamics that let Blair's lying slip by, the more people knew the paper was invested in finding a solution to the underlying problems that caused the breach. The same is true during any crisis. The more openly you speak about the problem, its causes, and its solutions, the more trust you earn from everyone watching, inside the organization and out. And during a crisis, trust is just what you need at every turn. Assumption 3. you and your organization's handling of the crisis will be portrayed in the worst possible light. In some industries, insiders keep score by market share. In others, they keep score by revenue growth, or number of new franchises opened in a year, or customer satisfaction figures. In journalism, they keep score by toppled empires and naked emperors. The profession's calling, as it were, is to question authority in its every form. I speak, of course, from experience. During my very public divorce in 2002, a controversy erupted around the perks that made up my retention contract, and the media had a field day. But that was hardly the first time I'd gotten my clock cleaned by the press. Not long after I was made CEO, during a period of wide-scale layoffs, I got labeled Neutron Jack, after the bomb that leaves buildings standing but kills people. A year later, I was named one of the toughest bosses in America. And believe me, the implication was not positive. During the Kidder-Peabody crisis in 94, I appeared on the cover of Fortune magazine under the headline Jack's Nightmare on Wall Street. The article includes a thesis about the cultural breakdown at Kidder-Peabody brought on by earnings pressure from GE. Public skewerings are awful. You're indignant and enraged. But no matter how innocent you think you are, or how superbly you think your organization is handling its troubles, it just doesn't matter. Reporters are not in the business of telling your side of the story. They are in the business of telling the story as they see it. That's the way the business works. And during normal times, you're usually happy for the so-called good read that journalists provide. And in my case, over the course of my career, I got far more than my fair share of positive media coverage. But during a crisis, all bets are off. You and your organization will be portrayed in a light so negative you won't recognize yourselves. Don't hunker down. You may want to, but you can't. Along with disclosing the full extent of your problem, as we discussed in the previous assumption, you've got to stand up and define your position before someone else does. If you don't, your lack of visibility will be taken as an admission of guilt, the same way it looks to lay people, albeit not lawyers, when someone does not take the stand in his own defense. Now, not all organizational crises have a public face. A middle manager leaves and takes his team with him. The reorganization of a business or unit causes enormous upset and turmoil. A big customer defects with complaints about your service. A fired employee makes angry charges of discrimination by senior management. Even if the media has no interest in these events, your people will. The same principles still apply. Openly discuss the situation. Define your position. Explain why the problem happened and how you are handling it. And just as with big public crises, don't ever forget you have a business to run. Make sure you are running it. Assumption 4. There will be changes in processes and people. Almost no crisis ends without blood on the floor. Most crises officially end with a settlement of some kind, financial, legal, or otherwise. Then comes the cleanup, and the cleanups mean change. Processes usually get overhauled first. With the time card situation, for instance, we instituted Policy 20.11, which formalized all dealings with the government. The policy was excruciatingly detailed, requiring us to cross every T and dot every I. Now, I am no fan of bureaucracy, but the time card situation in this case demanded just such a process fix. Sometimes, however, process fixes are not enough. We had had a policy about improper payments on our books for more than 30 years, Policy 20.4 to be exact, that was supposed to prevent bribery. But it didn't help us back in 1990, when a regional sales manager from Aircraft Engine conspired with a general in the Israeli Air Force to divert money from major contracts for GE to supply engines for Israeli F-16 warplanes. This was no small potatoes operation. The two men had set up a joint Swiss bank account and a fake contractor in New Jersey to cover their tracks. The media coverage around the world lasted 19 months through congressional hearings and a criminal trial against the GE employee, Herbert Steinler. At the end, he went to jail, and we paid the government a $69 million fine. In this case, the problem was not process, but people not enforcing an existing policy. No one in the business actually knew what Steinler was up to, and none of them gained a penny from the scheme. But some ignored warning signs that something was amiss. 11 people had to resign, 6 were demoted, and 4 were reprimanded. Crises require change. Sometimes the process fixes enough, usually not. That's because the people affected by the crisis, or sometimes those just watching it, demand that someone be held responsible. It sounds awful, but a crisis rarely ends without blood on the floor. That's not easy or pleasant, but sadly, it's often necessary so the company can move forward again. Assumption 5. The organization will survive, ultimately stronger for what happened. There is not a crisis you cannot learn from, even though you hate every one of them. From the time card crisis, we learn when you deal with the government, there can be no looseness with regulations, even if it means installing lots of detailed bureaucratic procedures. That's the price you pay for doing business with public agencies. From the compressor situation, we learn to bite the bullet early on product recalls. Doing that cuts your losses and pays off in customer goodwill. From Kidder Peabody, we learn to never buy a company with a culture that doesn't match ours. From the bribery case, we learn that policies age and even die unless managers work constantly to keep them alive. After a crisis is over, there is always the tendency to want to put it away in a drawer. Don't. Use a crisis for all it's worth. Teach its lessons every chance you get. In doing so, you'll spread the immunity. Now, there will always be crises, and when they erupt, man, can it be bad. It really does feel like your house is on fire and you can't get out. As hard as it sounds, try to remember in the heat of it all that eventually the flames will die down. And they will die down because of what you do. You will face the enormity of the problem and you will own its solution, while at the same time running the business as if there is a tomorrow. Then one day, you'll realize tomorrow has arrived. The smoke will have cleared, and the damaged parts of the structure will have been replaced or repaired. You will never be happy for what happened, but stepping back, you'll see something that might surprise you. The whole place looks better than ever. Now for the third section of this book. It's entitled Your Competition. The first chapter in this section is a chapter on strategy, with the subtitle, It's All in the Sauce. More than a few times over the past 3 years, I've been on a speaking program or at a business conference with one big strategy guru or another. And more than a few times, I've listened to their presentations in disbelief. It's not that I don't understand their theories about competitive advantage, core competencies, virtual commerce, supply chain economics, disruptive innovation, and so on. It's just that the way these experts tend to talk about strategy, as if it's some kind of high-brain scientific methodology, feels really off to me. I know that strategy is a living, breathing, totally dynamic game. It's fun and fast, and it's alive. Forget the arduous, intellectualized number crunching and data grinding that gurus say you have to go through to get strategy right. Forget the scenario planning, year-long studies, and 100-plus page reports. They're time-consuming and expensive, and you just don't need them. In real life, strategy is actually very straightforward. You pick a general direction and implement like hell. Yes, theories can be interesting. Charts and graphs can be beautiful. And big fat stacks of PowerPoint slides can make you feel like you've done your job. But you just should not make strategy too complex. The more you think about it, and the more you grind down into the data and details, the more you tie yourself in knots about what to do. That's not strategy, that's suffering. Now, I don't want to write off strategy gurus. Some of their concepts have merits. But I do want to disagree with the scientific approach to strategy that they propagate. It is taught in many business schools, peddled by countless consulting firms, and practiced in far too many corporate headquarters. It's just so unproductive. If you want to win, when it comes to strategy, ponder less and do more. I'm certainly not alone in this view. In speaking with many thousands of business people around the world, I can count the number of strategy questions on one hand. Virtually every other topic, from managing a temperamental employee to the dollar's effect on trade, gets more interest by orders of magnitude. Obviously, everyone cares about strategy. You have to. But most managers I know see strategy as I do, an approximate course of action that you frequently revisit and redefine according to shifting market conditions. It is an iterative process and not nearly as theoretical or life and death as some would have you believe. Given this view, you may be wondering what I'm going to say in this chapter. The answer is nothing that's going to get me tenure. Instead, I'm going to describe how to do strategy in three steps. Over my career, this approach worked incredibly well across varied businesses and industries, in upturns and downturns, and in competitive situations from Mexico to Japan. Who knows? Maybe its simplicity was part of its success. The steps are, first, come up with a big aha for your business. A smart, realistic, relatively fast way to gain sustainable competitive advantage. I don't know any better way to come up with this big aha than by answering a set of questions I have long called the five slides, because each set fits roughly onto one page. This assessment process should take a group of informed people somewhere between a couple of days and a month. Second, put the right people in the right jobs to drive the big aha forward. This may sound generic. It's not. To drive your big aha forward, you need to match certain kinds of people with commodity businesses and a different type entirely with high value-added businesses. I don't like to pigeonhole, but the facts are you get a lot more bang for your buck when strategy and skills fit. Third, relentlessly seek out the best practices to achieve your big aha, whether inside or out. Adapt them and continually improve them. Strategy is unleashed when you have a learning organization where people thirst to do everything better every day. They draw on best practices from anywhere and push them to ever higher levels of effectiveness. You can have the best big aha in the world, but without this learning culture in place, any sustainable competitive advantage will not last. Strategy, then, is simply finding the big aha and setting a broad direction, putting the right people behind it, and then executing with an unyielding emphasis on continual improvement. I couldn't make it more complicated than that if I tried. So what is strategy? Before we look at each of the three steps in some detail, a few thoughts about strategy in general. At the time I retired from GE, the company employed more than 300,000 people in about 15 major businesses, from gas turbines to credit cards. It was a complex, wide-ranging company, but I always said I wanted it to operate with the speed, informality, and open communication of a corner store. Corner stores often have strategy right too. With their limited resources, they have to rely on a laser-like focus on doing one thing very well. In our Boston neighborhood, for instance, within a block of each other on Charles Street, two little shops have constantly ringing cash registers and a non-stop flow of satisfied customers. One is Upper Crust Pizza. Its space is cramped, completely unadorned and noisy, with self-service paper plates and a limited selection of soft drinks. Customers can eat either standing up or sitting at one large bench-like table. The staff isn't exactly rude, but they're noncommittal. It's not unusual for your order, delivered at the cash register, to be greeted with a bland, whatever. But the pizza is to die for. You could just faint describing the flavor of the sauce, and the crust puts you over the edge. Investment bankers, artists, and cops start lining up at 11 in the morning to see the slice of the day posted on the door. And around lunch and dinner, the line can run 20 deep. A fleet of delivery people work nonstop until closing. At Upper Crust, strategy is all about product. Then there's Gary Drug, about half the size of a New York subway car. A large, newly renovated, 24-hour CVS pharmacy is a short walk away. No matter. Gary Drug, with its single, narrow aisle and shelves packed to the ceiling, is always busy. Its selection ranges from cold remedies to alarm clocks, with tweezers and pencil sharpeners mixed in. There is a personable pharmacist tucked in back and a wide selection of European fashion magazines in a corner up front. Everything the store sells matches the mix of the neighborhood's quirky residents. Salespeople greet customers by name when they walk in and happily give advice on everything from vitamins to foot massages. The store offers instant home delivery and a house charge account that bills you once a month. At Gary Drug, strategy is all about service. Look, what is strategy but resource allocation? When you strip away all the noise, that's what it comes down to. Strategy means making clear-cut choices about how to compete. You cannot be everything to everybody, no matter what the size of your business or how deep its pockets. Corner stores have learned that survival depends on finding a strategic position where no one can beat them. Big companies have the same challenge. When I became CEO in 1981, we launched a highly publicized initiative: be number one or number two in every market and fix, sell, or close to get there. This was not our strategy, although I've heard it described that way. It was a galvanizing mantra to describe how we were going to do business going forward. There would be no more hanging on to uncompetitive businesses for old time's sake. More than anything else, the number one or number two initiative was a communication tool to clean up our portfolio, and it really worked. Our strategy was much more directional. GE was going to move away from businesses that were being commoditized toward businesses that manufactured high-value technology products or sold services instead of things. As part of that move, we were going to massively upgrade our human resources, our people, with a relentless focus on training and development. We chose that strategy after getting hammered by the Japanese in the 1970s. They had rapidly commoditized businesses where we had had reasonable margins, like TV sets and room air conditioners. We ended up playing defense in a losing game. Our quality, cost, and service, the weapons of a commodity business, weren't good enough in the face of their innovation and declining prices. Every day at work was a kind of protracted agony. Despite our productivity improvements and increasing innovation, margins were eroding as competitors like Toshiba, Hitachi, and Matsushita were relentless. Meanwhile, overseeing GE Capital in the late 70s, I was shocked and certainly delighted to see how easy it was to make money in financial services, particularly with GE's balance sheet. There were no union factories, no foreign competition, and plenty of interesting, creative ways to offer customers differentiated products and services. I remember the excitement in that period, seeing how people develop new private label credit card programs and find niche after niche in middle market industrial financing. Fat margins weren't exactly low-hanging fruit, but close. By the time I was made CEO, I knew that GE had to get as far away as it could from any business that smelled like a commodity and get as close as possible to the other end of the spectrum. That's why we divested businesses like TV sets, small appliances, air conditioners, and a huge coal company, Utah International. It's also why we invested so heavily in GE Capital, bought RCA, which included NBC, and poured resources into developing high-technology products in our power, medical, aircraft engine, and locomotive businesses. Now, in such changing times, how and why did GE stick with one strategy over 20 years? The answer is that strategies, if they're headed in the right direction and are broad enough, don't really need to change all that often, especially if they are supplemented with fresh initiatives. To that end, over the years, we launched four programs to bolster our strategy: globalization, service add-ons, Six Sigma, and e-business. More than anything, though, our strategy lasted because it was based on two powerful underlying principles: commoditization is evil, and people are everything. Virtually every resource allocation decision we made was based on those beliefs. Yes, some companies can win in commodity situations. Dell and Walmart are great examples of companies that have pulled the levers of cost, quality, and service to succeed in extremely competitive games. But man, is that tough. You just can't make any mistakes. My advice, then, is when you think strategy, think about decommoditizing. Try desperately to make products and services distinctive and customers stick to you like glue. Think about innovation, technology, internal processes, service add-ons, whatever works to be unique. Doing that right means you can even make a few mistakes and still succeed. Now, that's enough theory. So how do you make strategy real? The first step is figuring out the big aha to gain sustainable competitive advantage. In other words, a significant, meaningful insight about how to win. To do that, you need to debate, grapple with, wallow in, and finally answer five sets of questions. Going into this exercise, I'll assume that you have a strategy to begin with, either written somewhere or in your head. That said, having a strategy doesn't mean it's working. The five slides we're going to look at here are a way to test your strategy, to see if it's getting you where you want to go, and figure out how to fix it if it's not, even to the point of changing it entirely. I strongly believe this questioning process should not be a wide-scale bottom-up event. While others may disagree, I know that strategy is the job of the CEO or the unit leader, along with his or her direct reports. If the culture is healthy, they can see the organization in all its various interdependent parts. They know its people, as well as its sources of ideas and innovation, and can best determine where the most exciting opportunities lie. Moreover, they are the ones who will ultimately commit the resources the strategy requires. They get the plaudits if the strategy succeeds and hold the bag if it fails. If you have a good team, candid, insightful, passionate about the business, and willing to disagree, completing this exercise should be fun and energizing. With intensity, it should take somewhere between a couple of days and a month. After that, it's time to act. Slide 1 lays out what the playing field looks like now. Who are the competitors in this business? Large and small, new and old. Who has what share, globally and in each market? Where do we fit in? What are the characteristics of this business? Is it commodity or high value or somewhere in between? Is it long cycle or short? Where is it on the growth curve? What are the drivers of profitability? What are the strengths and weaknesses of each competitor? How good are their products? How much does each one spend on R&D? How big is each sales force? How performance-driven is each culture? Who are the business's main customers, and how do they buy? Over the years, I've been amazed at how much debate this simple grounding exercise can spawn. In fact, it's not unusual for people who share the same office space to have widely different views of the same competitive environment. Many people have a terrible time admitting their business is a true commodity. No matter how hard we tried, it was next to impossible to get people in our motors business, for instance, to accept this reality. And I have sat through countless meetings where this set of questions has surfaced that discomfort and generated enormous heat about the level of resources to commit to R&D and marketing in an attempt to make the product more unique. Another of the many important issues this slide surfaces is market size. Too often people like to call themselves the market leader, so they end up limiting the scope of their playing field to make that happen. In our case, the number one and number two mantra inadvertently had that exact effect. After more than a decade, we realized that businesses were increasingly tightening their overall market definition, so their shares were enormous. We fixed that by saying that businesses had to define their market in such a way that their share of any market could not be more than 10%. With that restriction, people were forced into a whole new mindset, and opportunities for growth were suddenly everywhere. On the road, in Q&A sessions, this is how I talk about the market definition dynamic. Since I'm usually sitting in a chair, I ask audience members to imagine they are a chair manufacturer. They can define their market as the kind of chair I'm usually in, with curved metal arms, blue fabric, and wheels. Or they can define it as all chairs. Best yet, they can define their market as all furniture. Imagine the share differences and the implications for strategy. This kind of discussion is why this slide really deserves to be wallowed in. A rich, wide-ranging conversation puts everyone on the same page, just where they have to be to ultimately find the big aha. Slide 2, what the competition's been up to. What has each competitor done in the past year to change the playing field? Has anyone introduced game-changing new products, new technologies, or a new distribution channel? Are there any new entrants? And what have they been up to in the past year? This set of questions brings the players on the field to life. Competitor A has been stealing your key salespeople. Competitor B has introduced two new products. Competitors C and D have merged and are having all kinds of integration difficulties. Some of this information may have surfaced during the wallowing of the first question set, but now it's time to dig deeper into each competitor's behavior. Be granular. Almost know what each competitor eats for breakfast.